Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 19th of April. Our guest this hour, Bing West, the author of The Wrong War, Grit, Strategy, and the Way Out of Afghanistan. He says that our mistake in Afghanistan was to do the work of others for 10 years, expecting reciprocity across a cultural and religious divide. Given the huge size of the country, the tribal traditions, and the vast sanctuary of Pakistan, protecting the Pashtun population and expecting them to reject the Taliban in favor of the Kabul government was a strategy too open-ended. We have fought the wrong war with the wrong strategy. Our troops are not a peace corps. They are fighters. Let them fight and let the Taliban fear. Bing is a Marine combat veteran. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. He's the author of The Village. The subject matter of that book is counterinsurgency. No True Glory, The Battle for Fallujah, and The Strongest Tribe. He is a frequent contributor to the National Review. His articles also appear in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. He has been embedded with frontline troops in Afghanistan's most violent provinces and has spoken to well over 1,000 U.S. forces. The reviews of this call this a devastating critique of U.S. foreign policy regarding a seemingly endless war. And Bing has been called a battle-wise veteran, a skeptical journalist, and above all, a brilliant chronicler of America's post-9/11 wars. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Bing West, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
What do you mean? This is a fairly dramatic statement. We are not our troops a Peace Corps. Our troops are fighters. We're functioning as a Peace Corps in Afghanistan?
Well, we have been for the last 9 years. I mean, the thing that flabbergasts me, and I've been over there now for the last 4 years, you know, many times with our troops all over the place, is that we basically came right out and said, beginning in 2002, that we were going to nation-build in Afghanistan, which is a group of tribes hurtling headlong into the ninth century. And that's what we've been doing ever since. Our battalion commanders don't just fight over there. They also give out, each battalion, between $4 and $10 million a year.
Wow.
In aid. They're just giving it to people. And then they help the governors in all these districts. And then they try to bring something called the rule of law, which the Afghans have never heard of. So, yes, we've made nation builders out of our military. And that's wrong. They're not designed for it. And the irony is that Secretary Rumsfeld, when he was the Secretary of Defense, he said he didn't believe in nation building. But that's what we were doing. And now Secretary Gates has said the same thing, that he thinks it's crazy to be doing nation building, but that's what we're doing. So I'm mystified, what we're doing with our military and why we're doing it.
Should we be doing some kind of nation building? Should some other department in the U.S. government be doing that, or is that kind of a ridiculous thing to do right off the bat?
Well, after 10 years, I'd have to say if we wanted to try that, we chose the wrong country to try it. But if you're going to do it, that is the business of our Agency for International Development, uh-huh. And that is the business of our State Department. Let them do the politics. Let them do the developmental aid. And let our forces do what they do best, which is fight. I mean, the reason we went into Afghanistan was to destroy the terrorists who had attacked us.
Right.
It wasn't to build a whole new nation. We've become greatly distracted in why we went there.
You just said something that gives me pause every time I hear it. After 10 years, we've been there 10 years. That's such a long time, Bing.
Oh, yeah. That's why I've been advocating. And look, I love our troops. I mean, but I've been advocating that we have very good and very tough advisors. And we shouldn't be keeping 100,000 of our soldiers there indefinitely at $100 billion a year. We don't have that kind of money anymore. Of course, you people in Wisconsin really know that better than anybody. But we have to have the common sense to begin to trim back.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the Taliban. Tell me about how strong they are, where they are, if there is a single Taliban, who it is we're fighting. Are there offshoots of the Taliban? Who's the enemy now?
Well, let's start with that. The heart of this problem is that the Pashtun tribe that lives along the eastern side of Afghanistan, along the 1,500-mile border with Pakistan, 1,500 miles of sanctuary. There are about 12 million Pashtuns, and they believe that it's their birthright to be the strongest tribe in Afghanistan. And the Taliban came out of the Pashtun tribes. And the Taliban live both in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. And whenever there's too much pressure, they can just hop back over to Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So you have many small groups, but they do have a command and control system that goes back to the city of Ghetta, which is in southern Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pakistanis know where they are, but they won't pick them up and arrest them because the Pakistanis are hedging their bets for the future. And so as a result, you have determined fighters who are Taliban, who are disliked by the other Pashtuns, but you can't expect the average person to stand up against ruthless people. And because Pakistan's a sanctuary, this fight could go on, I'd say, for another 10 years.
Oh, my goodness. Are we going to let that happen, though? Will we have the will?
Well, I don't think, if you will, it's a lot of that's out of our hands. I mean, I think if we fall back and say, what are we doing? We don't want terrorists taking over the country and using it as a sanctuary to launch attacks against Americans, be they at 9/11 or any other place.
Mm-hmm.
But my argument is we can do that with many less forces than we now have.
You're talking about a much smaller group of very committed, very well-trained troops to neutralize the enemy, not protect the population, you say must be the main mission. So tell me about, do we have those forces now? How do they need to fight? How should they be fighting if they're not fighting now?
Oh, no. My argument is, look, we can do this with fewer of our troops by using more Afghan soldiers. That is, if we go to having advisors of, let's say, 50 to 100 that would go into combat, 50 to 100 of our soldiers and Marines per 500 Afghan soldiers in a battalion. So the ratio becomes about one American soldier for about 5 to 10 Afghan soldiers. Right now, the ratio is one American soldier for two Afghan soldiers. And I want to change that ratio. And I think we're going to. I mean, I think if you and I are having this conversation a year from now, we'd see a big difference there.
Mm. And are those soldiers, are we training those soldiers so we can do what you want?
Those soldiers are theirs.
Those Afghan soldiers.
You know, I don't think, let me turn it around and say, I can no more predict what's going to happen in Afghanistan a couple of years from now than I could predict the stock market. I mean, it's how things really turn out there really depends on whether there is a will within the Afghan government and the soldiers who volunteer to fight for that government, whether there's a will to win.
Mm-hmm.
And we won't know that until they're out there by themselves rather than us doing the fighting for them.
You talk about what would happen if we had a U.S. military pullout, what would happen in the short term, what may happen in the long term. It's hard to imagine that the American public will want to keep giving a whole lot of money to this war effort without substantial results for many more years. But you are asking us to remain committed, even though we change our strategy. What would happen if we left, Bing?
Well, I think if we left, sorry for stuttering, but I'm just trying to chew it in my mind.
Okay.
If we left abruptly, Afghanistan would fall apart because those who have come to rely on us would feel that we had abandoned them. Those who are opposed to us would feel they had won. And you probably would have chaos and a large civil war that would probably then spill over a little bit into Pakistan. But I can't conceive that any president in the United States would do it that way, nor would our Congress. I think they would all say that would be imprudent and rash. What we have to do quietly. For instance, we withdrew from Iraq, I think, fairly well. You know, we just did it a little bit at a time, but we were gone. You just woke up one day and we were no longer there the way we had been. I think we can do the same kind of thing in Afghanistan without worrying too much about the terrorists seizing Kabul.
And let's talk a little bit more about Pakistan. You write about the leadership of the Taliban and al-Qaeda, including Osama bin Laden, settling into the tribal frontier lands of western Pakistan, while the Pakistan military played a double game, accepting billions of American dollars, permitting strikes by American unmanned aircraft on al-Qaeda leaders. On the other hand, shielding other terrorist leaders as a hedge in the case the Taliban again seized power. What in the world? What should be the role of Pakistan? It seems to me as though you need a little bit more cooperation here from this ally, don't you?
Well, I mean, that's certainly putting it succinctly and in a way that I'm sure President Obama and Secretary Clinton would agree with entirely. The dilemma with dealing with the Pakistanis is I'm not sure they've reached a conclusion themselves. Mm. And as a consequence, You're having a talk with people who are very difficult to have a rational conversation with. They have their own ways of looking at the world, which is absolutely strange. And as a consequence, they see ghosts and they see spies and they see all kinds of conspiracy theories because it's convenient for them to. But we could say that about a lot of different people, and if they want to be psychotic, we can't stop them from being psychotic. So what's driving many of the Pakistani officials is they want to keep propping India up as their great enemy. And that way they have an excuse for keeping power on the one hand and not doing better for their own country on the other hand, because they can always blame somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're worried about maybe India somehow would make friends with Afghanistan, and therefore Afghanistan would become a satrap of India, and they'd be squeezed from both sides, because India, of course, is to the east and Afghanistan is to the west. But at that particular point, a reasonable person has to shake his head and say, wait, how far have you gone with your geopolitical conspiracy theories? But that's where the Pakistanis are, and as a result, they keep giving some aid to the terrorists, almost as though they're saying, okay, the United States is going to leave Afghanistan at some point, and we want to make sure if a radical government takes over that it's a radical government on our Pakistani side.
Mm-hmm. Is that where Osama bin Laden is right now, Bing?
Oh, I think I have no knowledge any more than what Secretary Clinton said. And Secretary Clinton said several weeks ago that she could not conceive that there were not some Pakistani officials somewhere in Pakistan who knew where Osama bin Laden was. I thought that was a pretty dramatic statement.
Hmm. So how do you get him to talk?
You don't.
You don't.
I don't think they will. Osama bin Laden, he may just die of old age. You better believe there's probably a lot of efforts to have them bumped off, and one of those efforts might succeed. Or the Pakistanis, at some particular point, for some particular reason, may say we've had it with having al-Qaeda here and move decisively against them. But I wouldn't bet the house on that happening, because those wilds of the mountains are just enormous, and sending armies in there You'd need a very good army to go into some of those areas.
You've spent a lot of time with troops and talking to thousands of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. What are they telling you? Is there any common thread about what they need to be successful? How's their morale?
Well, the morale depends tremendously on the small unit leaders, and that's why I call the subtitle of my book, Grit. We have about one half of 1% who volunteer out of the military-age males, volunteer to go into the military and go into the infantry that are called the grunts. So we're starting with a group whose self-image is that they're tough and they wanted a challenge, and they volunteered, which makes a huge difference. Once they get into their groups, the platoons and companies, these form small tribes, and they take a lot of pleasure in really being tough and being able to beat the enemy. That's where they really take their morale is if they're able to get into a fight and dominate in the fight. The greatest danger over there is the improvised explosive device, which can kill morale.
Yeah.
Because if you start taking casualties and amputees to mines, and you know the people know who put them in, but the people don't do anything about it and they don't warn you, then a unit can become cynical about the surroundings. And you need very strong small unit leadership to keep the morale up. So it really depends on how good your lieutenants are, whose average age is 24, and your platoon sergeants, whose average age is 26 or 27.
Wow. And how do you get those people to warn you? That doesn't seem right.
I mean, to which?
To warn you that there are these devices around.
Oh, I don't think that's going to happen.
You don't?
Really, there are two problems here. One I haven't figured out myself, and the other one is pretty self-evident. The self-evident one is if you have members among you, of the mafia, who are ruthless, they like the Taliban, and you all speak Pashto, and you're there, and you can't even communicate with an American, you're taking your life in your hands if you betray these others. You can understand that motivation, you know,
right,
that you want to stay out of it.
Yeah.
The other thing that bothers me a little just as much, though, is the question, is there a unity here among Pashtuns who are Islamic, tribal, and centuries behind us, looking at us as being the infidel who has money, but he's here only for a while, and then he's leaving, and therefore they don't feel an obligation to have to help protect you. That bothers me more, and I'm not sure I'll ever know how much is fear and how much is just, you're not one of us, and therefore we don't particularly care.
Mm. I can see why that would be troubling. We're going to welcome phone calls. Bing West, our guest. His book is The Wrong War, Grit Strategy and the Way Out of Afghanistan. He is a Marine combat veteran. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and has spent much time in Afghanistan. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls, starting with Habu from Madison. Hi.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for this opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to take what this person is saying seriously, and I say that respectfully, of course. The notion, before I make my main point, I just want to clear one thing he said. You know, this notion that we are there, nation building and Peace Corps, you invoke the term. I imagine many American commanders in the Pentagon wish it were that. The narrative, you know, this is the same narrative we saw in Vietnam. because they blamed it on the press or on the student riots in the United States against the war. And they said, oh, we're fighting in Vietnam with one hand tied behind our back. The war is the war is the war. And we were defeated in Vietnam. And even the Iraqis gave us a run for the money besides being, in spite of being decrepit. And so are the Afghans, who are clad in sandals and only use RPGs and small arms. So they're defeating the mightiest army the world has known. So this tells us something about how the people are feeling. They don't want to be pushed around. They're very proud people. They have defeated empires, and they certainly are not going to brook any rubbish from Americans or whoever.
Bing.
The notion that we can do it better is fallacious, and it is going to kill more American men and women, and a lot more Afghan people, and all for nothing. The United States is there to listen in on Iran, China, Russia, so and also the strategic minerals too, which that nation apparently has.
All right, let's get a response, Bing.
Hey, Havel, whoa. The United States is there to listen in on Iran and others. No. We're there for only one reason. 3,000 Americans were killed in New York City. No one disputes that. And they were killed by al-Qaeda under Osama bin Laden, who was protected by the Taliban in Afghanistan. That's why we went there. We went there to destroy the terrorists. Then we did stay because America does have this generosity of spirit. I mean, we are genuinely generous. We stayed to build a nation because we looked and saw that they didn't have much, and we believed we had to build a bulwark in order to prevent the terrorists from coming back. So we're spending just on Afghanistan, on the Afghans alone, between $10 billion and $16 billion a year. Year after year, independent of our troops whatsoever, just on projects for Afghanistan. And we're not doing that to get any mineral rights or anything. We're doing that out of a generosity of spirit. But my concern is that the generosity of spirit may be too much for our own budget to sustain. But we're certainly not there just to listen in on the Iranians or something. We went there because we were attacked in New York City.
And we're also there, it seems to me, and have been there for so long because we want to create something better, some kind of government that's better for the people. Can you talk about the corruption in Afghanistan that you see, whether or not Afghan forces would fight to keep a Karzai government, which is somewhat questionable, in power? What is it they're fighting for? And can you fight for something that seems to have quite a bit of corruption surrounding it?
Wow. I just don't know. I mean, I have no idea. And I don't think anyone is until we're no longer there doing the fighting for them. It's baffling. But the fact is that we went there with so much money that we were giving away. At every level, there is no village that you can go into in Afghanistan where the elders don't come up and basically give you a list of what they want. Because we did exactly what President Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, did in the 1960s here when he had his war on poverty and he had his great society, where he believed that if you just gave people money, it would improve them. And it didn't. But we took that same principle and applied it in Afghanistan. I don't think we've gotten any farther. But we don't know how to build another nation. We really don't.
Thanks, Abu, for the call. Jerry on the road. Hi, Jerry. Are you there, Jerry?
Perhaps seeding our future problems in Afghanistan. What I mean is, in the 1980s, when the Soviet Union had occupied Afghanistan, we armed and trained the Mujahideen to fight back. And now I believe we are fighting against the very same Mujahideen, and they're using our equipment and our tactics against us. Could this possibly backfire in the future with training Afghani forces today? Will we be fighting them tomorrow?
I kind of doubt it, Jerry. I mean, you do, after a while, know who's basically on your side. And this disease of jihadism, this zealotry of the Taliban and al-Qaeda, affects only a very small minority. The interesting thing is, you know, when you're out there with the Afghan troops, I am often, and you ask them, can you tell who is a real Islamist jihadist? And interestingly enough, the Afghan soldiers tell me, no, we can't. They're very good at deceiving, so you don't know what is really driving them until they turn against you. And I found that to be really kind of interesting. But most of the people in Afghanistan, no, they're not opposed to us in any way. It's this small group of true haters who really try to motivate people by Islam, but they don't motivate most of them.
Can you give us an example? You talk in the book about creating this professional advisor corps and more task forces, like, I don't know how you pronounce his name. Is it Goldstein's?
Goldstein, yes.
Goldstein's, yeah. In the coming year. Talk about Goldstein. What are you talking about here?
Well, Matt Goldstein, for instance, is a special forces captain. And I was spent quite some time in a battle called Marja with the Special Forces, and Operational Detachment Alpha is what they call them. And here you had 12 Americans who had volunteered, and they had been in their Special Forces their entire lives. Just all they do is try to train other nations how to fight. They're adventurers. They're mature. They know what they're doing, but there aren't that many of them. And the interesting thing is, there are only a dozen of them, and they went into the battle. And their average age is about 32, and they're very, very professional, but there are very few that are that good. And they said to the Marine Colonel, Matt Goldstein said, well, he said, sir, I'm here with my 12 Special Forces, and we have 400 Afghan soldiers, but 12 of us, we can't be everywhere. We can't do everything. So I'm not really sure how much we can really help with these 400 Afghan soldiers. And the colonel said, well, what do you need? And Captain Goldstein said, well, sir, he said, I'd need a regular infantry platoon and some engineers. And the colonel said, fine, you have them. So he gave Captain Goldstein a Marine platoon and some engineers, and Captain Goldstein had this big smile on his face. He said, you know, this is the first time my sergeants have been able to get a full night's sleep. We now can really spend our time explaining to the Afghan soldiers what they have to do. Somebody else is taking care of guiding the camp and clearing the roads, etc. And I walked away from that, and I said, wow, this is what you should do. You should take your best trained older advisors and give them some of these young hard charges we have to take care of the everyday details while they attend to what they're really good at. And that would mean expanding our advisor corps, but I think it would really pay dividends because we need fewer Americans. We could have the Afghan soldiers doing more.
Rick in Greendale, hi.
Yes, I'd like to ask the guest about building the camaraderie amongst the local people. Do they have their own army bases? The Afghan army? Do they have? Or are they part of? They always report to the U.S. Army base, and everything goes out of U.S. Army. Because I think that would be a big morale booster for the Afghan people to have their own army posts. Work out of them independently. And also to address the other concern, you mentioned it's hard for locals to get the word where they can turn in tipster line kind of thing. I would think that once the patrols are out walking around, there must be some way that everybody in the local community can be noted that, you know, if you ever want to give us a tipster, you just have to walk by and drop a note that's in the shape of a piece of paper, in the shape of, you know, a few folds, and our guys will pick it up. And nobody will know who dropped it. And how creative are we at really building community, cooperation with these Afghan people, I guess?
Well, Rick, there are two aspects to it. First, in terms of the camaraderie, I had a combined action platoon of Marines and Vietnamese in Vietnam. And we all lived together. We did everything together. Right now, all the Afghan soldiers are partnered on bases with Americans. And that varies from base to base how close they are, but they're all right there with each other. The dilemma you have with the Afghan army is that most of them are not Pashtuns. They're other tribes, and they speak Dari. They don't even speak Pashtu. So often when you're out on patrol, the Afghan soldier has no more capability of communicating with the local Pashtuns than does an American. In terms of the dead drops that you're indicating and the intelligence techniques, et cetera, we haven't done as good a job as we should have at this. Our special forces are good at it, at getting local networks and explaining to them how they can pass on tips without getting killed. But the Afghan soldiers are not good at it. They haven't thought in those terms. So it's a weakness, Rick. It's definitely a weakness.
Yeah. I'm wondering, let me figure out how to ask this. It seems to me as though a man in your position who has seen so much war and really been on the front lines, that your head is full of knowledge here. And let me ask about the knowledge that's in your head from being in Vietnam and how it informs you when you're in Afghanistan, if at all. Does it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one war, I went from Vietnam, and of course, then I fought in Vietnam, and I reported for years from Iraq, and now I reported for years from Afghanistan. After a while, you get to know battlefields the minute you walk on them and sense when something is out of the ordinary. And some of the cues are very, very commonsensical. Often you see the people literally running away. Now, if you don't take a signal from that, there's something wrong with you.
Right.
But other times you can see what we call patterns. You can see the pattern developing of how they fight. And if you can get our forces to understand the patterns, then they too can quickly pick them up. The great danger, I think, is not allowing our troops to get cynical about the people with whom they're dealing. They're not really dealing with them because you're not allowed into any Afghan compound. No American goes into an Afghan compound. So you're really not among the people the way some people say you are, and you have no way of communicating with them. Most of the patrols don't have an interpreter with them, so it's difficult. You're out there walking until the Taliban decide to shoot at you, and the greatest danger is the mine.
We go to Janice near La Crosse. Hi, Janice.
Yes, hi, good morning. Thank you. I just want to know how we can get away from, I appreciate your guests and respect him, but for me, it's kind of a military mentality that we seem to always take on this violent killing, suppression, that's going to do it. Like the other man said, it didn't work in Vietnam to our surprise. And now it's not working really in Iraq not working in Afghanistan. And just what you said, we're not knowing the people. I still like the building of nations, I still think the Taliban are really the minority. It's just a matter of getting to know these people, trying to help them. I know there's so many tribes. I mean, this is a challenge, but I really feel if we could focus on peace, all that military energy, focus it on peace rather than let's just find them, let's kill them, let's get rid of these people. And that never solves anything. War never really accomplishes anything. I mean, we still need to go and do the humanitarian thing is to help these people and educate them and try to make it a better world for them, and have them have something to look forward to. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Janice.
Well, Janice, where do I start? I can simply start by saying, I guess I'm one of these old-fashioned Catholics who doesn't believe in the perfectibility of mankind, that every century you get better people than you did in the prior century, that we all have original sin and we all go through a series of things in life where there is good and evil that continues to struggle. And the fact is that in the 20th century, even though we had much more education and money than we ever did in prior centuries, there really was many more wars and destruction in the 20th century than other centuries. So the notion that we can just build peace while it's desirable isn't the case. It wasn't the case in World War II against the Germans and the Japanese. In the Vietnamese case, violence worked. The North took over the South by violence. We're in Afghanistan only because they killed us in New York City. I mean, by just hoping things are better, but by turning a blind eye to those who will destroy you, I'm afraid that doesn't work in this world. And we weren't doing anything wrong when they struck us in New York City. So there's no way we can compromise with Al-Qaeda. As far as Al-Qaeda is concerned, Westerners have to be killed. And when you're dealing with that kind of a person, you must destroy that organization.
Thanks, Janice, very much for the call. You have, and I found these really interesting at the end of the book, your counterinsurgency lessons that are adapted from your other book, The Strongest Tribe. Let's go back to money here for a moment. I was really dumbfounded when you said that we've got, millions of dollars in aid that the military is supposed to be distributing. You do think there's a role for money, and I wonder how effective this has been. The U.S. military, you write, has no competence to restructure an economy. Every platoon and advisory team should have a monthly allowance of several thousand dollars to disperse for goodwill and information. Is that included in the amount of money they already have, and is that effective in Afghanistan?
Well, yes, but that's trivial. I mean, that's like many police detectives have a small allowance they can use for information to pay informants. That's all I'm talking about, small things that you might do for goodwill or to get information. Nothing like the billions and billions and billions of dollars we're now spending. Do you know that we have something called the Commander's Emergency Response Program for our battalions? That's $1.2 billion. What happened here? I mean, this is nuts. We don't know how to spend $1.2 billion.
I know.
As battalion commanders.
Well, where is all that money going?
Well, it goes to everything. But, I mean, it's everyone laughs about it, but we still do it. I mean, look, if you have that kind of money, everyone in Afghanistan knows you have money. You cannot go out on a patrol without somebody walking up to you and saying, Derizma, Derizma. That's the one word they all know, and that means chit. And they'll hand you a chit. And we initially, out of the goodness of our hearts, gave all our sergeants chits. And if any battle damage was done, if you drove a truck through a field or something, you went to the farmer and you handed him this chit and you said, we drove the tires over your crops, even if they're poppy crops, and we estimate this is $200, and here, and it sign your name to it.
Right.
And they could just collect the $200.
Right.
Well, we didn't realize that, of course, some commonsensical person would rush over to Pakistan and fraudulently, come out with a couple of million of these and hand them out. So everywhere you go now, somebody walks up and hands you one of these things. In other words, if somebody believes you have money and you're just going to give it away,
right,
everyone gets in line to get the money.
Yeah, right. Oh, my gosh, it just sort of knocks you out, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah.
Because you have to ask, what's the purpose in doing this? What do you think you're gaining by doing it?
Yeah.
And the answer is that we do have this belief. I mean, President Johnson believed that he could win in Vietnam, not by fighting, but he offered them a Tennessee Valley Authority project. I mean, just like Janice was saying, President Johnson actually offered to build a huge system of dikes, both in North and South Vietnam, and Ho Chi Minh laughed at him. I mean, Ho Chi Minh was in that to win on the battlefield, and Johnson thought he could just, you know, buy it. You can't.
Mm-hmm. Joe in Milwaukee, hi.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe this spiel about how Americans are so generous and open-heartedness, you know, that we want to spend billions in Afghanistan. You know, those are all American industrialists getting taxpayers' dollars over there working, number one. Number two, every bullet shot over there is going in the pocket of some industrialist military guy here. Number three, you have all of these drone aircraft bombing all of these weddings and that. I was looking at some magazines, National Geographic, on Afghanistan from the 60s, and the heading on the front page was Afghanistan, the Crossroads of Conquest. You know, the English have been kicked out of Afghanistan about three times. Russia, now the U.S. is there. When I talk to people on the street I know, you know, I say, why do you think we're in Afghanistan? They say, for the poppy market. You know, what else is there there? You know, and you think, well, that sounds weird, but, you know, European powers have dictated the southern Caribbean islands for years for sugar beet crops. So I guess if they had military installations in those islands for sugar beets, why wouldn't they for poppies? That's a multi-billion dollar deal.
Bing.
Joe. Where do we start this conversation? Well, let's start it with, you don't believe we're there being generous because it's going into the pocket of American industrialists. Now, I've been all over Afghanistan, and I have yet to see this industrialist that you're talking about. When you're out there with captains and lieutenants and sergeants, and the money is going to the tribes. You don't have some guy from Wall Street traipsing along with you. In terms of the drones hitting weddings, I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, we have fantastic video. Video as good as what you see at the Super Bowl from the blimps. And we go to extraordinary lengths to check all those pictures. I don't know where you are with this.
But we have haven't we hit civilians? Hasn't that been a concern, hasn't it, that those drones
have hit
civilians?
That's a legitimate point. We, in the 21st century, you know how people are going to fight us, not just this time, but every time? They're not going to wear a uniform. And, well, you can say, well, good, they shouldn't wear a uniform. Well, you got to think of that one carefully. Why do people in the military wear uniforms? That convention began about 400 or 500 years ago in order to stop armies from slaughtering the civilians because the army didn't know who the enemy was, and therefore if you were all at risk. So all countries agreed that if you were going to fight, you had to wear a uniform. Now you're getting to these non-government people like the jihadists who don't belong to any government, who say, we'll hide among the people by not wearing a uniform. That makes it very tough, and we've been, I would argue that America has become, and the United Kingdom, the most restrained armies the world has ever seen in terms of the degrees to which they will go to avoid shooting, in many cases, in ways that we did in Iraq, and we certainly did in Vietnam, and we absolutely did in World War II. So we've become more and more restrained on what we're doing. As far as Joe's final point about we're there for the poppy, hello? Wait a minute. You know, we walked through fields of poppy. I was just there 2 weeks ago, and down in the south, and when we were walking on patrol, we're walking through the poppy field. We have nothing to do with that. The people who come to collect the poppy, we keep telling them, if we find you with a certain level of raw opium, you will be arrested. So we've tried, but our chances of finding the person are low, but we try to indicate to a farmer, we're not here to get into that, although there's something deeply wrong with it to begin with. But if you're trading in it, and we can catch you, we're going to put you away.
Yeah. Why do you keep going back? This is one heck of a dangerous place, and you've done your time.
Well, because I believe that Exactly, because I've done my time. That is, I'm an infantryman. I'm a Marine. I understand what's happening on a battlefield and why. And I feel somebody should kind of tell those stories. That, therefore, in my book, I try to go into what are we really doing up in the north and down in the south, so that there'll be some record of what actually is being done. Because most of our reporters today did not serve in the military. It's all volunteers. And therefore, they have a little bit of a different perspective. What I try to do is explain what it looks like if you are an infantryman and what you've been doing.
More phone calls in a moment. Bing West, our guest. His book is The Wrong War, Grit, Strategy, and the Way Out of Afghanistan. Thanks for your call, Joe. We have time for a couple more phone calls. I'll give you the number because you might be able to get in if you call now. 800-486-8655 is our number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Tony from Portage. Hi, Tony.
Hello. Thank you for having me this morning.
Sure.
So many topics. Good grief. It's really hard to pick one, so let me just pick one. first of all, I'd like to... Dean, I am also a former Marine, combat veteran of Vietnam.
Well, semper fi, Tony.
Semper fidelis, sir. First, I want to say, in comment to a previous caller who happened to make mention of our quote-unquote defeat in Vietnam. No, sir, we were not defeated. In the larger sense, whether it be by virtue of an unintended consequence, we did stem the tide of communism in the rest of Asia. That being an effect of perhaps our opponent, namely the old Soviet Union, having to put so much resource into fighting us in Vietnam that they could not concentrate their efforts in other areas. So that being said, I think we have a big problem in America, and that is with our mindset. We look at the Muslim faith as our enemy, and this is our greatest tragedy. The Muslim faith is founded in a belief in God and obedience to God. And in private conversation, in private personal conversation with many associates, mostly co-workers of mine, who happen to be of the Islamic faith, they see these perpetrators, the Mujahideen, the Al-Qaeda, and their brethren as being I don't even know what to say. They are a voice against God. They're wrong. But we as Americans lump everyone together, and that attitude must change.
Bing.
Well, I don't know, Tony. I agree with you. Let me come back to your basic point first. The notion of tides of history, and that was what was happening in the 1960s. And I agree, you can't write the alternative history, but the alternative history would have been what could have happened in Malaysia, Indonesia, et cetera, had we not been in Vietnam. And so I'm like Tolstoy. I do believe in his philosophy of history, that history is not an accounting of great men, but rather it is an accounting of when societies feel that there is a wave that is going with them. That said, the notion of Islam here, I detect really no intolerance in our country. I think we're very tolerant. I'll use as the example this hate-filled person in Florida who burned a Koran. The American public knew scant about it, and it inflamed nobody. And our press, to their credit, downplayed it. What I thought was very disturbing was that President Karzai, and the president of Afghanistan, decided to make a huge big deal of it and stir up the people as though indicating that this was common in America. And as a result, two members of the United Nations were beheaded and another five shot to death. And that really disturbed me about Karzai. I feel that the leaders of the Muslim religion in many of these nations have much more an obligation to speak out against murder. And by that, I mean the Islamists who are the suicide bombers who just slaughter people. And you hear very little public condemnation from their own leaders for that. And I think that's a disgrace.
And one final question, just give me a few seconds, if you would, because we're out of time. Are those people growing in number, or are we defeating them?
Oh, I think as long as we have the madrasas, these religious schools in Pakistan, they're certainly not getting less. Mm. They're certainly not getting less.
Mm. Bing, thank you very much.
Thank
Thanks
you.
For the hour. Our guest this hour, Bing West. His book is The Wrong War, Grit, Strategy, and the Way Out of Afghanistan. He is a Marine combat veteran. He served time in Vietnam. He's been in Iraq, and he's been in Afghanistan many, many times, was Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up and many more hours of great conversation ahead, so please stay with the station, and we'll be with you again tomorrow morning starting at 9 o'clock. Thanks for listening. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's about a minute before 11 now, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.